On RN, this is the final episode of A Short History of Video Games. I'm Dan Golding. It's almost impossible to chart where video games are today, although so far in this series, I've taken you through experimental computer labs, to the arcades, to the home, to all over the globe. Today, there are so many different types of video games that it's difficult to know where to begin. So here's a few examples of where video games are at today. One of the most significant games in years is called Dysphoria. It's free, and you just play it in your web browser. You don't need any special equipment or tech, you just load it up. Dysphoria is an autobiographical game by someone called Anna Anthropy, and it tells you the story of her experiences undergoing hormone replacement therapy. Here's what the first screen of Dysphoria says. I feel weird about my body. You are given a set of goals to achieve, but you can't. There are barriers in the way. The game has set you up to fail, and because this is a video game, you feel that failure so much more personally. There's a point being made here. A friend of mine, a games critic, told me that Dysphoria was the game that inspired a generation to create. Even though it's only from 2010, more than any other game I can think of, Dysphoria showed the world that games could be different. Here's another side of video games today.
What you're seeing is advanced warfare.
Everybody ready?
Hoorah! This is the latest Call of Duty game, a $10 billion franchise made by hundreds of people in studios all around the world.
Politicians don't know how to solve problems, but I do.
It's a wildly over-the-top military shooter with a Hollywood sheen. This one stars a digital Kevin Spacey, and it's the kind of thing you'll see advertised on the side of buses. But to me, Call of Duty is almost camp in its masculinity. You know, lots of men yelling about war and explosions and all that. So video games can be incredibly personal, even autobiographical like Dysphoria, or they can be macho, expensive propositions created by hundreds of people like Call of Duty. And they can be everything in between. So with this range, video games must now be for everyone, right? Well, that's actually a really complicated question, and one that I'm going to try to answer today in the final episode of A Short History of Video Games. I'm going to start this latest chapter in Australia in the early 2000s with a game that pushed the boundaries of what games could be and angered the federal government in the process.
And finally today, to the controversy over a virtual reality video game in which players escape from Australian immigration detention centres. The publicly funded Australia Council has granted the designers of the game $25,000 to further develop the concept. The Immigration Minister, Philip Ruddock, is not amused.
This was in 2003, when it was announced that the Australia Council had funded a video game called Escape from Woomera. Catherine Neal was the game's creative director.
I was doing my day job, working on console games, often licensed titles. That means a TV or a movie franchise that gets made into a game. I felt like I want to do this for the rest of my life, but I want it to be something more, you know, like I want to be like my indie filmmaker friends. I want to be like my friends who work in television, you know, public broadcasting, where, like, you have creative scope to explore possibilities that don't have commercial motives. And I thought that, you know, people like me and my colleagues should have the right to do that too. I really do feel that we were sort of considered second-class creatives.
Catherine Neal was also an activist at the time and was interested in ways to bring attention to Australia's refugee policies.
And here was a subject matter where we could engage with a secretive issue where people couldn't see inside these centres, and game developers could recreate these detention centres based on evidence that we, you know, we're talking to ex-detainees, we were talking to people inside, phone calls, and we had inside information, and we could take that information and model, like in 3D, these environments that news photographers couldn't even see. So it kind of was a unique opportunity in that respect that game developers could bring to this issue, I think.
Despite what would prove to be a strongly negative public response, Catherine Neal and the Escape from Woomera team decided to be as thorough and factual as possible.
We recruited an ABC journalist, Kate Wilde. She was an investigative journalist for The Chaser, actually, and she just finished that. And yeah, we basically recruited her and she was amazing. She hunted down leads, she conducted lots of interviews with ex-detainees, she found a lot of secret information, she tracked down maps, you know, what an investigative journalist does. Because we wanted to be rock solid on that stuff. So she worked closely with Ian Malcolm, the game designer, and he, whenever he needed, you know, I need a gameplay device for this, what can you give me, Kate? And she'd go, well, this happened and this happened and that happened. There was like, we had a SIM card that you smuggled in with Omo washing powder, and that actually used to happen because in the game we were inspired by actual escape attempts and real life within the detention centre at Woomera. So people used to smuggle SIM cards in like boxes of washing powder. So we, you know, we put that in there.
When the funding was announced, the Escape from Woomera team found themselves at the centre of a political war. Many of those working on the game had to do so anonymously and so couldn't publicly defend themselves, including Catherine Neal.
It was frustrating, and looking back, I have regrets. I should have just quit my job or something. But as a game developer with an employment contract, I wasn't allowed to work on my own projects outside of work, let alone controversial ones, so I was afraid about losing my job.
And it certainly was controversial. Escape from Woomera faced criticism from all sides.
I'm absolutely appalled that this could happen, and I would hope that Minister Ruddock would take this up at his level. The Arts Council is acting like a traitor to this country.
That was Joy Baluch, the mayor of Port Augusta near the Baxter Detention Centre in 2003. These kinds of concerns were taken very seriously by the federal government.
The immigration minister at the time, Philip Ruddock, accused us of inciting criminal activities, like because breaking out of a detention centre is a criminal act. And David Kemp, the minister for the arts, ordered a ministerial inquiry into the Australian Council and its funding decisions, and they had to go through a process to review the way they make these decisions.
The Immigration Minister has questioned the judgment of the Australia Council, and refugee advocate groups have labelled the game a disgrace.
In any context, this is wrong. It's just wrong to have amusement or games or any of those sort of activities on the back of the plight of these people who have been detained in the Woomera Detention Centre or any detention centre here in Australia.
The Refugee Council of Australia and the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission were very critical. And I would say that, and I, you know, personally I came back against that, saying that some of this is snobbery. You know, like Charles Chaplin made a film called The Great Dictator, where he satirised Hitler. Now, if you can use a film to deal with serious subjects, we weren't making a comedy game, just to make that clear. But if you can make, you know, a film like Schindler's List, very, very serious topic, you know, about the Holocaust, why, when you put that topic in a game, is it trivialising? Are your feelings that it's trivialising based on your prejudice against games as a medium? And I think now, how long is it, 11 years later, I think people, attitudes have changed. But back then, games, you know, we were second-class creative professionals, it was a second-class medium, and yeah, so people thought games trivialised serious topics.
Regardless of politics, Escape from Woomera was a vital link in connecting video games to the wider culture, not just in Australia, but anywhere in the world. Helen Stuckey, a researcher at Flinders University, thinks that Escape from Woomera was crucial in sparking debate about the role of games in society.
And the game was incredibly effective at asking questions about what games can do, in ways that, you know, not many people were exploring at that time, and particularly to do so with such a controversial subject, and a subject that was desperately being trying to kept out of the Australian media. So it's an extraordinary achievement, you know, intellectually ambitious achievement in what it tried to do.
For Catherine Neal, Escape from Woomera was about pushing games into new territory. Catherine, do you see people doing that now?
I think games as legitimate culture, that argument has definitely been won now. So I think, you know, as a young developer today, exploring political and personal and interesting themes in your work is perfectly legitimate and encouraged. So the identity of being a game developer, what it means to be a game developer, has broadened. You can be, in effect, liberal arts educated hipster and be a game developer now. And people think that's normal and cool even. Wasn't cool when I was a game, when I was starting out as a game developer. It was the height of nerdiness.
I feel like Catherine was squarely looking at me with that last comment, as I fit her description almost a little too well. But she's got a point. Making games is now pretty cool, and it's even cooler if you're making something personal or something political or provocative. Video games still have their fair share of problems, but the right to make games that have got something to say was won in part by the battles that Catherine Neal and her like fought in the early 2000s. This is A Short History of Video Games. I'm Dan Golding, and I'm at something that would have never have existed in the Escape from Woomera era. It's a video game party. We're in a bar in Bennett's Lane in Melbourne, where a group called SK Games has set up about half a dozen locally made games with projectors and custom-made controllers. They brought a lot of these from Perth, where they're from. They rented a minivan and drove it over. They've even got tour CDs of games to sell, like a band. There's about 50 people here, lots of beer, and a DJ in the corner making music with a Game Boy console. A local video game designer who's here is Andrew Brophy. He's making a game that tells his own story.
It's a game called Knuckle Sandwich. It's about my late teen years and how I jump from job to job in the hospitality field. And basically, it's about how terrible and boring and mundane it is. And yeah, that's what the game is. It's a very boring game. But in it as well, you kind of, I guess, dream about what could be better. It's very much the American dream, I think, but set in Australia, if that makes sense.
And so you put your personal experiences into the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, the funny thing is you meet so many incredible people, like, that are actually ridiculous through such boring jobs that I, you know, you had to put them into a game or just some artistic medium, and obviously games is my medium of choice.
Also here is Brendan Keogh, a local video games critic.
A lot of developers are starting to speak from a much more personal perspective when they make their games, which is probably largely because the kind of AAA blockbuster space, when you've got 100 or 200 people making a game, it's going to be hard to make that personal for 200 people. It's more, has to be accessible to as many people as possible. Whereas if you have one or two people making a game and making it in their bedroom, not necessarily for commercial reasons, they can put a lot more of themselves into it, whether they mean to or not.
Oh, that's cool!
It's what some people call the new arcades movement, getting together in bars and playing games together as well, sharing a drink and heckling each other.
Games have definitely become a lot more accessible, not only to play but also to make. To me, a lot of the events that are coming out is just a natural result.
Let me introduce you to Chad Toprak, who you just heard, and two others, Amani Nassim and Louis Roots. All three of them make indie games, but with a twist. They also run events for these games to be played live, at parties, at pubs, and in public. In fact, Louis runs SK Games and was the organiser of the games party that I went to. Chad Toprak is the co-creator of an organisation called Hover Garden in Melbourne, and Amani Nassim is a member of the Copenhagen Games Collective.
Games are an amazing way of being social. When you play a game together, it opens up so many possibilities. And if you play a game in a difficult space or about a difficult issue together, it just flips your mind and opens up different ways of looking at it.
Yeah, I find that the events side is really what, you know, I would like to push more. It would be nice if one day I could say to a venue that I want to book bands in for an evening and have local games as well without them, you know, having no idea what I'm talking about.
And what are the kinds of reactions you have from people who might not have played a game in a public space before or for the first time? How do people feel about this?
I guess in my experience, firstly, people find it quite surprising and fascinating that video games are being played in public, right? It's something that we don't usually see. People usually pass by and they're really curious as to what's going on. So sometimes they ask, sometimes they just stay back and just watch from a distance, and that's completely okay as well. But for the people who are a little more interested, I guess, we tend to approach them and invite them to play, you know, without forcing them or anything. We're just like, hey, you should totally join.
There was a policeman who really wanted to join.
Oh, yeah.
But he was on duty. I was there at one of the
Hovergarden
at Hardware Lane, and there were people who were passing by who came to join in. And then there was the police car who stopped, and he really wanted to join in, but he was on duty, so he couldn't join in. It was completely different from when I played in public in the Maldives. We made an event, and there had been a coup, and the situation on the streets were really tense. So the police came, and they were like, where's your permission? And in that kind of situation, it was really difficult for people to come out and move their bodies and play outdoors while others were watching, because it might have been seen as political or I don't know. But it was just really hard because all public actions were extremely politicized.
The kinds of games that these three make really focus on creating a social experience more than anything else.
I've kind of been frustrated with seeing a lot of missed opportunities for social interaction, right? I'm on public transport and everyone's on their phone with their heads tilted down and they're all playing something or reading something. And it just saddens me that, you know, there's all these people around and this potential for some sort of interaction, but a lot of time it just never happens. So I made a game called Cartload of Fun. It was a two-player cooperative game designed for trains and trams, right? So we had custom hardware built and attached to the poles that people hold onto while they travel. And it was really interesting to see a lot of passengers play it for the first time and everyone else just watching in awe, going like, whoa, what's going on? We had one person come over. I was setting up and he looked at me. He goes, what's going on here? He was like this really tall, like he had this mean face. I thought he was like some official. And even though we did have permission, I got taken aback and I was like, oh, okay. You know, yeah, we've got permission. We're students doing a research project and things like that. And I invited him to play. I said, hey, you should join us. You should play. And then he looked at me and he said, I don't play games. And I was like, whoa, okay, it's all right. And he thought about it for a little more and finally said, yeah, okay, I'll give it a go. And so I started to play with this person. And as we started to play, his face, his reaction to the game slowly started to change. And as we played, he was getting into the game. You know, I could clearly see he was starting to have a good time. And when the game was over, he would be like, oh, is it okay if we play again? I was like, yeah, totally, let's do it. Definitely, let's play. And that was the day I changed, like, one person's attitude towards games.
Chad Toprak, changing the world one commuter at a time. For his game, Louis Roots turned a car into a video game.
So we got a car, cut it in half, because we only needed the front half, and we thought that would be easier. Turns out it wasn't. So we had to get rid of the airbag, which I'm very, very worried about. Do airbags explode? This one didn't, so we push that car up against a wall. We project the screen onto the wall, which is sort of the road going away from you. And the driver sits in the driver's seat and drives, and the passenger sits in the passenger seat and attempts to shoot any sort of all the enemies that appear in front of the screen. And it's an amazing party game. People love playing with it. Even when it's off, people will just climb all over it. Because, as I said, it is a real car. The steering wheel is still hooked up to the wheels.
It sounds like you've made a little playground.
Yeah. When I was growing up, there was a restaurant in Bunbury that had an old steam engine. It was just basically where my parents would put me and my friends when they had dinner, and it was just a steam engine, and you'd just climb all over it. There was nothing interactive about it. But the idea of just having, here's a thing, you know, like it doesn't have to be a designed playground. It's just climb all over it, do what you want, you know, play. And it's just kind of funny that I remade that as an adult.
I think that what all this tells us is that video games have become a kind of everyday vernacular for a generation. People want to play. I'm Dan Golding, and on RN, this is a short history of video games. So if video games are now an everyday activity, does this mean that everyone plays? This is a little bit complicated, as there's actually a word for video game players that I haven't used in this series at all so far. It's gamer. It's this term that sums up a lot of these ideas for me. Are gamers just people who play video games, or is there a gamer identity that means more than just a taste for play? At the Penny Arcade Expo in Melbourne, a huge games event, I ask people exactly that. Do they see themselves as gamers?
Yeah, I definitely do. It's something that I always found a little bit intimidating growing up, I think, because so many of the gamers that I knew were sort of older guys that didn't really want to welcome me into their little group. So as I got older, I just started exploring games by myself, and I realised how much I loved it and found this little community at conventions. And yeah, now I definitely identify as a gamer.
I suppose like in my teens I did, but nowadays like looking at gamer culture, I don't really like to associate myself with it. I kind of see it as a little bit dirty and consumerist.
As a kid, it's not something that I even saw as a label. It was more in my teens. I think when you're trying to find that group to identify with, yeah, gamer was something that I felt comfortable with, and I still do identify myself as a gamer, definitely.
I wouldn't consider myself a gamer. It's got some negative connotations for me with gambling. I enjoy games, I make games, but I'm not a gamer.
I know plenty of people that would definitely not identify as a gamer but love games. My mum, for example, has been playing games for as long as I can remember, at least as long as I've been born. And there's no way she'd call herself a gamer, but she's been playing all sorts of games. Yeah, going back to Nintendo, Atari. Throughout my childhood, mum was always the one that played games with me.
I mean, like, I look at my dad now and he's playing like Monument Valley and 3s and stuff, and he doesn't really classify himself as a gamer, but you know, he's just as much of a gamer as I am nowadays, really. Maybe he's played less, but you know, he still enjoys games, so I just think nowadays it's a little bit of a redundant term, really.
Yeah, there definitely are games snuck into things that people don't even realise. So yeah, people are playing games without knowing they're playing games, and they're not identifying as gamers.
Everyone plays video games, so if everyone's a gamer, then no one is.
So who actually plays video games, and who might think of themselves as part of video game culture, are two different questions. Christian McRae is a lecturer and researcher of video game culture at RMIT University.
We are in a period of there's sort of a mass hallucination going on, where we believe that people who are playing Candy Crush and Where's My Water are looking for great game design experiences, but they are looking to socially connect with their friends, and that's what those games are providing. You know, I think what people are looking after when they open their phone and they're playing Candy Crush is just to stay on the level with their workmates and to say, yes, I'm sort of addicted to that game, just to have a kind of reference point, no different than catching up with a TV show. But I don't think even people talk about it that much around the water cooler. It's just a constant sort of mild pressure to keep up with the Joneses when it comes to mobile video games. And I think it's great to see when I look over someone's shoulder on a tram and I see that they're playing something that's maybe a couple of years old, I think that's great.
With mobile games, Facebook games, and indie games, it's easy to start thinking that traditional studio-produced video games are no longer relevant. That's not quite true. This is Assassin's Creed 4, Black Flag, from 2013. It was produced by French company Ubisoft and made in its studios in Montreal, Annecy, Bucharest, Kiev, Montpellier, Singapore and Sofia, a true multinational effort. It's a game about pirates, and it's actually my favourite mainstream game in a long time. It's like one of those perfect films from Hollywood's golden age of the 1930s, where films would be churned out by highly skilled production lines. You sail around the Caribbean, singing shanties, before spotting an enemy ship, downing its masts, and then boarding and capturing it. It's a lot of fun, and it could have only come from a big studio.
If the game is good, and it has a positive social relationship in it, it shows something unusual, but it's also promoted on the side of a bus, and it's also promoted on children's TV, then it can perform things that relate to wider culture. How many games live up to that potential and promise is debatable, but you cannot shut down the hope that a mainstream game can do something interesting, because that way madness lies.
The best video games can be confluences of sound, music, architecture, art, theatre and more. And players respond to all this in their own ways, making games their own. But contemporary games culture does have its own pressures too. Christian McRae.
When I think about the current era of video games, I think about being unable to play everything. I think about a person who might be 13 or 14 or 15 who calls themselves a gamer. But with all the other things you have to do to be a gamer, watch the YouTube videos, read the websites, listen to the music, go to the conventions, you're going to miss most of your chosen genre. I can't even imagine the pressure that you would face if you were young. That's the main thing I think about. I don't think about the era of game design. That's less interesting to me than how young people come into video games, which is way more fractured than we thought it was going to be.
Fractured. That's how I'd sum up video games going into the future. While the history of video games might be complicated and surprising, the future will be doubly so. From science labs in Boston to cyber cafes in India, the history of video games has taken us to some pretty unusual places. Now that video games are everywhere and played by everyone, they'll go where humans go. But where video games are going is also always shaped by where they've come from.
Because games are absolutely obsessed with the evolution of technology and technology progression, the best game is always the next game. And that's the way games are marketed to gamers. There is a culture of forgetting inherent in how we are told to consume games.
So remembering where video games have come from is as important as getting excited about the next big game. On our end, this has been a short history of video games, produced by Amanda Smith. I'm Dan Golding, and you can download all four episodes from the website abc.net.au/rn. Look under V for video games in the program list.